You know, I also think pragmatically, as someone on the right, we're dying as a species. We're not going to exist anymore if we can't get ahead of some of these issues. And the fact that things related to voting so often align with issues related to race, we cannot ignore this anymore. We have to get ahead of this. So I think from a pragmatic point of view, that's also where I come from. And then also, as someone who served as a police officer and a prosecutor, you know, I look back at my career and I look back at punishment and I look back at rehabilitation and, you know, what is the point of the criminal justice system? It's about public safety. I don't think you can point to very many things as it relates to disenfranchisement from voting in other areas that actually helps people get rehabilitated. It always surprises me that my brothers and sisters on the right act all surprised that people don't want to participate in our democratic process when we have disinherited them from the American dream. And voting is the central part of that. So that's kind of, you know, broad strokes where I'm coming from, both philosophically and personally.
Neil, do you want to go ahead and share? Yeah.
Yeah. And thanks for having me on here, Jacob. I appreciate the opportunity. From my perspective, I mean, I'm a 20 plus year conservative and I've been active in politics for a long time, but definitely right in the middle, right smack dab in the middle of that process. I got a felony conviction about 13 years ago. And it came out of just me being selfish and stupid and crossing lines that I shouldn't have crossed and making decisions that I regret that I made. And in the process, I, you know, hurt people around me and I created a breach with my community and have been working day by day since that point to heal that breach and to heal those wounds and to try and live a life of integrity and walk this out the right way and actually embrace the idea of a second chance. And in that process, I've gotten to meet, you know, so many people who, like myself, are formerly convicted, who have struggled to get reintegrated into the community. And I've just met some amazing people, you know, who made some mistakes, have embraced that whole concept of forgiveness and redemption and restoration. And then you see these systems that are set up and they actually are set up in a way that almost create incentives for people to not reintegrate into the community, to not reintegrate with their families and not live up to their God-given potential. And I've been able to walk that out firsthand. I moved to Florida after I got in trouble as a way to kind of start over again, really not thinking that I'd be involved in politics ever. And lo and behold, I moved to, at that time, one of the four states that permanently barred people from getting their voting rights restored because of a past felony conviction. And I ended up working at my church. I ended up running a drug and alcohol recovery program, became the chair of our homeless coalition. I was really engaged in the second chance community, not really thinking about politics or anything like that. And then I met this guy, Desmond Mead, who was actually the person who led this entire movement down here in Florida. And it was kind of a spiritual thing for me. I realized it was something that I needed to get involved in. And what I got to witness and see was an amazing group of people and families who, you know, we're dealing with this policy that was broken. We saw politicians on both sides of the aisle for decades here in Florida promising to fix the system and seeing why it would make sense to help, people reintegrate into the community after they've completed their sentences. And nothing happened. So we saw this groundswell, this movement start from the bottom up. And it was awesome, to be honest with you, like just watching people rally behind the most civic minded thing you can do, like sign some petitions, send them to a PO box. And before you knew it, we got 80,000 petitions which in our state means you trigger the ability to go to the Supreme Court and see if you're what you wrote, the petition itself is constitutional or not. And when I think about that moment, that day, I look at all the families all over the state from Florida. This was not like a partisan thing. This wasn't anything but a commitment from people who had shared experiences with the criminal justice system, people from Key West, the Panhandle, Orlando, Miami, everywhere. And it was awesome. Once we crossed the threshold to get to the Supreme Court, and they ruled that we have a constitutional amendment that we could place it on the ballot, it became a much more professionalized campaign at that point. It really grew. We got paid petition gatherers, right? And so it kind of took on a new life of that. But for me, it's always a reminder that the heartbeat of this whole thing, what was going on here in Iowa, what happened in Florida, are people, real people's lives, our friends, our family members. We know them, like people with felony convictions are in every community. And at the end of the day, this is just an opportunity for us to do community together and base it on some basic principles of forgiveness, redemption, and restoration.
Neil, you mentioned going down to Florida, and that was a state recently where they did change the law. Talk a little bit about what that process was like and just how overwhelmingly it did pass, because I'm pretty sure it wasn't that close of a vote, if I remember right.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And I tend to go into the kind of the backstory a little bit, especially when given an opportunity, because I think it's important, because a lot of times we want to speed up and have these conversations through the lens of right, left, you know, red, blue, and kind of that partisan lens. And our movement, our family, is decidedly not built that way. We are united behind shared experiences around the criminal justice system. If you go into rural Florida or you go into urban Florida and you talk to the family members of people who have been living with felony convictions, the stories and the challenges are the same. And what we saw is that there's a real, ability to enact change if we avoid leading with our partisan interests, right? So when you talk to somebody in downtown Miami and they talk to you about the challenges of getting housing because of a felony conviction, the inability to get a job or a job license because you have a felony conviction, it's the exact same thing that you would hear in rural Florida when somebody says, hey, I can't go to school or I can't seek opportunity because I have a felony conviction. You know, those things that united us is how we decided to walk this out. And so we ended up getting about 2/3 of the vote, very bipartisan. Almost half the people who voted for Republican Governor Ron DeSantis voted for Amendment 4. You know, so it was a really cool process, man. And for somebody like myself who really thought I wasn't ever going to have an opportunity to get back involved in kind of the give and take of public debate and public policy, to be able to take part in something like this that really transcended that whole kind of partisan deal was really cool, man.
And you had to cross a couple more barriers in terms of restitution, right? There were some things in that law that needed to be refined maybe by the courts.
We've had a little bit of a roller coaster with the court system since the legislature passed their bill let me back up, right? So the way it worked in Florida was we passed the initiative November 2018, 65% of the vote. And then the legislature enacted clarifying legislation, and that clarifying legislation was signed into law by the governor. And then that legislation was taken to court, both state and federal court. And it's been continually working itself through that process, like you mentioned.
Arthur, when you look at this issue, how are the folks that want, obviously, their right to vote to be restored, how are they also being mindful of the pain and suffering that they caused the victims, if there were victims in those crimes, I guess? How are they kind of balancing those things out?
Yeah, I mean, real quick, I also worked on the Florida bill, and then I wrote an amicus brief for the Fifth Circuit, for the Circuit Court when it went up there, not the Fifth Circuit. So, you know, I'm not somebody who has a criminal history past. I don't have a record. So I'm going to be talking as someone who has lots of friends and works in this area. I think that, you know, we have to really think about where is the stopping point for punishment? And I'll answer your question in a second. But I think that what your question does is really highlight something for me. Somebody is punished. They serve their time. They get out, they have some type of community supervision, and we can debate whether or not people should vote while they're on community supervision. I think there's room for argument there. But at a certain point, it's over. We've gotten our pound of flesh. We have said that we have gotten our rehabilitation. And if we're going to perpetuate this idea that you're going to be continually dunked underwater as part of like this idea of punishment, that is one, that's not very American. And two, that doesn't actually play into the idea of rehabilitation. And by the way, punishment is only one pillar of the criminal justice system out of five pillars. So I'll start there. And then as I go forward, I absolutely think that victims have a huge voice in the way things are supposed to play out in the criminal justice system. I do know that many victims advocacy groups were actually in support of the Florida measure, but more kind of this national idea that people should be able to come back. You cannot have this idea of second chances if nobody is allowed to actually have that second chance. And so I think that different victims groups are would have different opinions. But I would say all of the ones that I work with, which I think would be the majority of the groups out there, believe that there has to be a lane for people to come back to the fold. So as it relates to individuals and how they're actually viewing this, listen, anybody who actually wants to get their right to vote back after a conviction, those are the types of people that we really should be encouraging to do so. I'm sure there are people out there that are just, I don't know what word you want to use. They're just shits. And there's not a lot you can do. There might be future crime ahead of them. But quite honestly, those aren't the people that are really going to be advocating for their right to vote. So the individuals that this is going to impact are the people that we should care the most about. They're the people that really want to come back to the fold. And we should be really advocating for them to do so. And I think that, you know, Neil might have a better answer because, you know, he actually falls into that group of individuals that have actually are trying to come back to the fold. So I think that he should have a bite of that answer as well.
Can you ask the question again, Jacob? I'd love to make sure I got my frame right.
Yeah, I just wondered what process or what thoughts are kept in mind for those who do want their voting rights to be restored, to also maintain that level of respect and recognition for the victims of the crimes, assuming it was, you know, a crime that involved a victim, of course.
Yeah, no, I'm with you 100%, and I appreciate everything that Arthur said and his voice and his wealth of knowledge that he brings to this conversation. From my perspective, I think I outlined, like, when you create this breach in the community, right? Like it's a spiritual thing. It's a community thing. It's a family thing. If that's where the breach was. And so it's important to make sure that we work to restore that. Right. So like when we were campaigning, and I campaigned in almost all 67 counties of Florida, going, you know, to group to group to group, like we wanted to make sure that restitution was a part of that process. You know, if you owed individual restitution, that's a part of the restoration process, like personally, you know. And so I think that is a really invaluable question. We did have a variety of the victims organizations who work with victims, many people who, you know, their internal organizations would talk about these issues, and they could see how this could help stop this cycle of violence, and all the data would show that, you know, if you allow somebody to have a voice in the community, if you fully allow somebody to reintegrate into the community, you can get to this kind of that gold piece of data around recidivism, right? Because 95% of the people are going to come out of incarceration, right? People are going to come off community supervision. And what we all want, including the people who are coming out, is the ability to reintegrate in the community, reconnect with loved ones, build a social network, you know, work on those things that we might need to work on to be, you know, better members of the community. And part of that is restoration. Part of that is dealing with the junk that we brought us to this place. So on a very personal level, yeah, I mean, that was a part of our conversation with the public in Florida, was that we understood this idea of restitution, and especially a restitution to an individual, which I know is a part of the conversation here in Iowa.
Yeah. Arthur, you talked about it earlier a little bit. It seems like the pushback, if there is any, comes from Republicans, but it's very divided within the party because there's also support for it. So what's your message, I guess, to the Republicans that are kind of either on the fence or have strong feelings that this doesn't if it happens, then it has to happen in such a way that truly does honor and keep in mind victims, and restitution has to be fully paid. What's kind of your message to those folks?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So I like how we're using the right language, because very often you get in these conversations and people don't. They combined fines, fees, and restitutions in one ball. And you know, if you notice, Neil was very precise in how he used the language. Fines and fees, period. Restitution, period. They're two separate things. I absolutely do not believe that we should be holding people underwater for life while they are paying their fines and fees. Categorically, I do not think that's something we should do. Restitution is a little bit different. I do think there's ways that we can have a conversation. I think that is the point, the negotiation ground, in my opinion, is where you can negotiate when it comes to actual restitution. So yeah, you're right. The thing that you hear most from individuals on the right are things to the effect of, well, they have to be fully paid up on fines and fees. Then it gets kind of ridiculous. You know, they have to have all their arrearments to childcare have to be met up. And then the list just gets longer and longer. And what happens is you just end up in a place where you have a de facto disenfranchisement. And so I think that, you know, this is a public policy issue. And so what I mean by that is we have to look at what is the actual thing we're trying to affect. We're trying to affect the criminal justice system. I mean, that's the whole point of having this, right? We want to have a safer place. You know, the criminal justice system is supposed to be for public safety. And there is zero evidence out there that voter disenfranchisement actually makes us safer. So the first thing that I would say to my brothers and sisters on the right is, what are you trying to achieve? If you're trying to achieve public safety, you're not actually getting there. Now, if you're trying to achieve some type of quality of, you know, feeling like you're whole for the victims, well, that's a legitimate argument that I'm willing to listen to. But when you force people into a place where they can never get their rights back because they have this enormous, debt that they owe, I don't think that actually affects, public safety. And I don't think that makes victims feel any better. And I think I'll go back to my comment that I made last time is, you know, when does punishment end? And is restitution part of punishment? If restitution is part of punishment, I think that we're really going down the wrong path, because you really aren't ever going to get out of that. Many people are going to be sentenced to life in many cases because their restitution is so enormous. We want to look for to ensure individuals are participating in whatever agreement that they're in due to a plea or whatever they were sentenced to. If they were convicted. But after that, we have to give them an avenue to come back. And so many times the compromise that I hear from mostly Republicans is a compromise that isn't really achievable. It's a false choice because it's not something that people can't ever really get back to.
When it comes to fines, fees, restitution, those different things, is that something, Neil, that you think is easily understood among the general population, the general public, or is that something that's kind of difficult to know unless you've been in the shoes of a felon?
I'm always hesitant to like paint too broad of a brush around a group of people. So my experience with the public is that this issue, we used to have a 20-minute cup of coffee rule early on, especially in the campaign, before it became, you know, you're talking through, you know, mainstream media or paid media or something like that, where 20 minutes and a cup of coffee with somebody talking about this issue, we were almost at 100%, right? Where you're kind of like, let's have a conversation about people. Let's talk about folks in your community. Let's talk about folks in your family. Let's talk about people in your church, you know, like kind of have the real conversation as it relates to what it is that we're really discussing here, a lifetime ban on, you know, one of the most important parts of citizenship, having your voice heard in a local election or a national election. And so in that process, to get to your question, I did find that there were quite a few people who were not aware of how the criminal justice system was funded, how the criminal justice system worked, and therefore this might be a sliver where they really needed to get educated. But then the other side of it was a realization that there is a lot of families who, you know, somebody's cousin, somebody's neighbor, somebody's daughter, somebody's mom has had a brush with the criminal justice system, and that therefore it was relatively easy to get into this kind of conversation between, hey, what's a court cost? What, you know, what's, how does that compare with restitution, right? Like, you know, I could easily have a conversation with somebody and talk about, like, look, if I broke into your car and I stole your $500, you know, stereo, right? Like, and then I go deal with the punishment and the consequences of my stupid behavior, right? I owe you $500, right? In the process, though, there are thousands of dollars that are also being assessed to me, you know, in the process of doing business within the court system. And I think in those moments, that's when the public, and then even the elected officials, when we were going through the process, because you'd see, you know, the elected officials are symbolic of the public. Some really know it, some don't, you know? So I just think that there is a process of giving people the benefit of a real conversation so that we can come to some grips with understanding that this is a human thing, you know, as much as it is a public policy thing or something to debate about or something to draw the lines on, that at the end of the day, most of our families in some way, shape or form are impacted by this because it's so prevalent.
Yeah. And to add on to that, you know, It's when you start to explain people how fines and fees actually work, where it's not just, oh, you got hit with a $200 fine and a $200 fee and a $3,000 fine, you know, due to some crime. They have compounded interest. Plus you have to pay, you know, supervision fees. And by the end of the day, you know, we have people that are making the decision whether they're going to feed their families or they're going to, stay up to date. And those are real choices that people are making. I know that makes me sound like a hippie, but at the end of the day, what is the whole point of this? The whole point of this is to make us safer, and keeping people, again, underwater for a life sentence does not make us safer. It actually makes us, it makes people feel less connected to, you know, the community. It makes them feel less connected to family. And that is how people fall back into the trap of crime. When they feel like there's no hope for them to get out. And, you know, yes, again, there's a category of individuals that this may not apply to, but I found that is a good chunk of it right there.
Yeah. This next question, it may be fair, it may not be fair. So we'll see how you guys feel about it. But when you're talking about the right to vote, when you're talking about election law, you would think at the end of the day, for the two political parties in charge, they're going to come down on a decision that they think benefits their political party the most. I think that that's fair. So do you think there's an idea within Democrats that make them think that if felons are suddenly allowed to vote, they're going to have a big new voter pool? And on the flip side, do you think Republicans have an idea that if felons are allowed to vote, those are votes that they're going to lose? Do you think there's any reason for that thought process, if that is a thought process that goes into it?
There's no doubt that Republicans think that this is adding votes to their column. And there is no doubt that Republicans think that that this potentially can hurt them in the short term. But that is the major problem that I have with my political ideology right now, is it's so short-sighted. You know, the percentage of Latinos who voted for Reagan really didn't change between, I mean, Trump was a little bit lower, but it's about this. It's always been about the same. But the percentage of Latinos in America has changed dramatically. So even though it's the same percentage, the number of votes that accounts for is fundamentally different. Like I said early on, we are going to become extinct as an ideology unless we can get ahead of this. And people are not stupid. People see how these issues are directly related to issues of poverty, directly related to issues of race. And if we cannot get ahead of that, we are doomed. And I know that sounds, you know, scary, but I'm scared about this. I am worried that we are going to no longer have a voice in the political process if we cannot get ahead of this. And this criminal justice reform in big capital letters is one of the ways that we can do that. It makes us look more fair. it makes us, it helps us be seen as you know, an ideology that cares about justice and it cares about individuals that the justice system affects, and we have to get ahead of it. So you're absolutely right, and I think that is a very fair observation. But I also think that everybody who's looking at this is looking at it through a very short lens that I really hope we can get over.
Yeah, and when I think about the question, and like you said, Jacob, it's a fair question, right? We're here having this conversation. Like I tend to think of like a governor or decision maker, right? You know, who is an elected official. They've always got that man or that woman, that person in the room, right? Who is their job is very much to look at things through, you know, hey, the X's and O's, the straight up partisan kind of calculation. So I appreciate where that's coming from. I would say that our experience in Florida, though, has also informed me in the idea that these things are fluid and that sometimes we project onto the returning citizen populace, the language we use in terms of for people with past felony convictions. We felt that a lot. There was a day of campaigning that always stuck out in my mind where, like, within a 24-hour period, I had been at a bike festival, in which our little table was right next to Bikers for Trump, you know, and we were having a grand old time. I was at a NAACP event, and then I was at a Trump event, right? So I was at a diverse set of people talking about returning citizen issues, and some person from DC had actually flown in and had a whole group of us returning citizens together, like 12 of us in a room. And it turned, this conversation came up, and he just looked at us like, hey, so are you guys Republicans or Democrats? Right. And I knew that he had a preconceived notion, and it hit me in that moment that aside from me, who came from politics, most everybody in that room, they were nothing. Right. They've been discarded by society. They weren't even allowed to be Republicans or Democrats. Right. So even this whole idea of like, hey, we're going to project onto you what we think you are, I think does a disservice to the people who do that. And I tend to look at it a little bit more like there's a diversity within the community. Right. For returning citizens in Florida, one of our top issues right now, and I'm telling you, it's explosive, is the fact that this PPP funding for small businesses does not allow that to go to people with past felony convictions. And in our community, the people who helped build our network and this movement that passed Amendment 4, 1 in 4 people probably have their own businesses because they wanted to succeed. They got out, right? They got off community supervision. They got that job like I did, a minimum wage job, and then realized that the rung doesn't, you know, you can't get a job license. You can't get that $17 an hour job or that professional job because you can't get the license or it's not available to you. So what do? You become an entrepreneur, right? So in my mind, I'm like, there's a natural affinity for conservatives to reach out to small business owners and people who have that entrepreneurial fit. And it is strong within the returning citizen community. At the same time, like I can see how Democrats would want to like kind of create this like extension of, hey, we're going to create programs and programming to help people. And honestly, like I can see how there would be some people who are in that situation where that isn't alluring to them. But man, it's the give and take, right? I got to go win hearts and minds. And I think that's the strongest and most important thing to take away from a conversation about how people are going to vote is, you know, hey, are people voting for Donald Trump or they vote for Mitt Romney? Because I promise you, within the returning citizen community, Donald Trump's going to do better than Mitt Romney did, you know? So there is just a difference between how you're coming at folks, what issues are you talking about? And then, you know, let the games begin, right? I mean, that's, we see shifts in demographics and we see shifts in the public all the time. My hope would be in Florida, at least, that we're going to have more conversations around issues like how do you get access to jobs and how do you create entrepreneurship? How do you create these avenues of opportunity for people? And I think that the either the right or the left, whoever cultivates that, is going to do really well with this group of voters.
Yeah, and I'll just add, I agree with everything that Neil just said. He said it a lot better than me. But you know, with what I said earlier, I also, you know, resist this idea that there's these groups of people sitting around in rooms twiddling their fingers, you know, saying "wahahaha." How do we prevent people from voting in order to, you know, affect our elections? I do think there is the perceptions exactly the way that Neil laid it out. But I also don't think there's some mass conspiracy, you know, that people are engaged in order to suppress different groups, you know, with these laws. I think it's something that is kind of baked into our system right now. If you look where many of the voter disenfranchisement laws come from, I mean, it's not a secret. We know where they come from. The one in New York, we actually have the legislative record that lays out exactly where it comes from. I do not want black people voting. That's what they said in New York. And that is how many of the other states progressed with this. So we know where these laws come from, and we also know how to fix that perception. So I just want to add that too there. I don't want people to think I'm a conspiracy theorist, but I do think that it's a very real thing that individuals take into account as they're working on these issues.
So 2020, Neil, is this the first time that you're going to be able to vote here, and how long?
Since 2004, man.
Okay. So Florida, you guys have primaries down there, or have you voted yet, or what? Where are you at?
I have not. I will be voting in the Republican primary in August in my community. So I'm excited about the opportunity to get in there and do it again, man.
Yeah. What have you given much thought what that's going to be like? I mean, for most people, it's going through the motions. I mean, for a lot of people this year, it sounds like they just as soon vote by mail. They don't want to go to the poll, whatever, with the coronavirus. But for you, obviously, it's going to be very personal. So how are you planning on casting your ballot?
I plan on doing it in person. And it's interesting you say that, because I really haven't thought too much about it. But every time I think about it, I'm like, I know it's at Life Church right up the street. I'm going to walk up there with my wife. I'm going to vote. You know, so I really appreciate the question, because the way it worked down here was on January 8th in 2019 was the day when Amendment 4 was enshrined in the Constitution. So all over the state, like down where I live, you know, my wife, friends, bunch of us returning citizens all had breakfast. We went down to register to vote. And the truth is, man, like in that moment, like I was so frustrated with the partisanship, right? Because there were friends of mine, like Arthur said the word conspiracy theorists, man. There sometimes with voting, especially people are like, oh man, they're gonna try and shut down the supervisor's offices and all this stuff. And you know, and I was just like, I've talked to my supervisor election, like he lives 10 minutes from me, you know, like this is actually, we do community together. And they rolled out the red carpet. They had like the American flags out. Like it was a celebration. And since then, man, I feel like on so many levels, I have the best job in the world, because almost every couple of days a week, I get somebody texts me on my phone, a picture of them with their voter registration card. So whatever happens, right, however it all plays out, like it's going to be a celebration, you know, for so many of us who I've had the honor to walk with over the last 5-6 years as this kind of whole thing has been building in Florida. And I'm just excited to see other people vote, have their voice heard. I'm excited to go in with my wife. Like it's weird, and I'll shut up after this. He's clearly got me excited. It is weird. Like, I think that if you take the political science, and we have to do that and really study the data, but if you think about human beings, people, I think about so many like fathers and moms who probably are like creating an environment in their household to disencourage their family members and their kids to vote, right? Why? Because they have a felony, right? So instead of just being like, hey, let's talk about voting and then bring up the label that you don't want anybody to talk about, instead you're just like, ah, they're all, you know, I don't do any voting, it's not important, but right, and creating a culture of, you know, and so what we're seeing is like this intangible impact of the family members around people with felony convictions who are just as excited because suddenly mom or dad or aunt or uncle are fired up to go vote. And for me, like in this kind of cynical time period, especially, man, it's fun to be around folks who are like, man, I'll go bust through a brick wall to go vote, you know? So I'm going in person, and I really didn't think about it until you asked, Jacob. So thanks for that, man.
Yeah, no problem. So criminal justice reform overall has been something that has seemingly been embraced by President Trump a lot more than maybe it had been by Republicans in the past. Do you guys get that same sense? And if so, how much of an influence do you think he has kind of as the head of the party, the head of the country, and pushing those reforms?
Yeah, I'm on a call with the White House every week that is precisely dedicated to this idea of promoting second chances. And the president is very dedicated to the idea that we really need to, you know, second step still is on his agenda. It's really focused around employability, especially for individuals with criminal history records. Second chances is something that is still brought up every single time. So I absolutely think it's still on the agenda. I think the president sees this as a true win for him. And I think that the proof is in the pudding on that one. And how is it resonating across the nation? Well, I think one of the best things that it has done, and I have a white paper out if you guys are interested in it. It's called, what the hell is the name of it? Keep Calm and Carry On with Criminal Justice Reform. And the premise of it is how the number one thing that the First Step Act did was give a nod to red states that it's okay to do criminal justice reform, that nobody's going to, you know, call you a rhino if you do that. So I think we have taken this issue on, and we have on the right really kind of run with it. You know, most of the people that I know that are actually getting bills passed on criminal justice are on the right. And we know how to work on the left. And what the left does, and, you know, I'll say this to my friends on the left that work in this space, is they eat each other. And there's this constant battle for not only fundraising dollars, but issues where they become purists and nothing gets done. It's why you see so many bills fail in so many blue states. I mean, I just tried to pass a bill in Washington state and it failed the last second because, well, mainly because of COVID, but the main battle I had was with my allies on the left. But on the right, we really know how to come together on these issues and know how to get things done. So I'm very optimistic that it's still on the agenda. I mean, I have been told from the president that it's on the agenda. So I'm excited about what the next steps can be.
Yeah. And I would just say that, I mean, facts matter, right? And so to sit around and talk to family members and people who have been impacted by the First Step Act, for instance, I mean, that speaks really loudly. You know, we live in a world with a lot of people questioning what's facts, what's not facts, what's real, what's hot air. You know, I mean, we hear that constantly. And so to actually know that there are real people who've been impacted by the policy changes that the president has both pushed and signed, I think that goes a long way to breaking through the clutter when it comes to criminal justice reform. You know, the issue around of hiring people, right? Like, I mean, that was also a big step forward in terms of making sure that federal jobs, you know, that's easier for people with felony convictions to get access to jobs. What we've found is that we've done surveys of thousands of returning citizens in Florida as we've kind of tried to walk our way through this process in a healthy way that represents the will and the guidance of real people and real families who are returning citizens. And what you see are just bread and butter issues. I mean, it is not like people are not getting off community supervision and like, man, I got to go protest that restaurant because they're not vegan. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I need a job. I need access to housing. I want to figure out what kind of opportunities are available. Like, how do I get access to money? How do I get access to higher education? You know, those are the things that continually come up in all of our surveys as just the bread and butter issues that people care about. I think people are very aware of issues kind of bail and sentencing reform and all the like kind of things that go along with criminal justice reform. And that becomes a part of the conversation. But, you know, when you start talking about people who are trying to reenter the community, people with past felony convictions, man, that's bread and butter issues.
There's a lot of people who have never been felons. So you guys have talked a little bit about it here so far. How do you educate those people what it's like to try to work your way back into society when your resources more than likely are very limited and you have different hurdles that are placed in your way, fair or foul? You have different hurdles placed in your way almost at every turn. I mean, for people that have never been a felon, they have no reason to understand how you guys have to navigate those things.
I think Neil said it best earlier on when he said this is an issue about people. And I think people generally understand that. Most, listen, I run into people every once in a while that are just stubborn, set in their ways, and they're just not going to change their mind when it comes to criminal justice. They're tough on crime, and they're always going to be tough on crime. But the vast majority of people that I come in contact with that aren't in my crowd understand that people make mistakes. People make big mistakes. And people need to have the ability to come back. That is the American way. We have lost that over the last 40 years. But I think we're slowly gaining it back. But I think the exact sentence is that soundbite that Neil gave you earlier. This is an issue of people. This is a people issue. And we need people solutions, people-centric solutions in order to win over hearts and minds. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding. We've been able to do it. You know, we have less people in prison. We have the sentencing changes have actually, you know, decreased the length of time. Most states have passed something that actually has, made their state a little less focused on incarceration. So I'm optimistic. And I think the fact that I've been able, you know, personally to win over my hard ass, Republican friends is proof that it's possible.
Well, there's also probably things that people have in mind when they close their eyes and picture a felon or picture a felony act that isn't necessarily the case. I mean, you can be a felony for a number of different reasons, and I'm sure it varies state to state, right, Neil?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point. I mean, I know even when it came to, for our experience in Florida, right, like we went around and we talked to people about what they thought a felon was, so to speak, and what their worries were and what their fears were, and even led to kind of our decision on having these carve outs in the amendment, you know, so that it did not affect people who were found guilty of murder, did not affect people who were found guilty of felony sex offenses, and part because just the acknowledgement of what you just said, that sometimes when people think about it right away, man, that you go right to the worst kind of crime that could have happened. And we knew just kind of on a deep, like, emotional, psychological level that in November of 2018, so if you were to talk to me in 2015, 2016, like, we knew, like, hey, if they're voting, if people are voting in November of 2018 because they think it's about a governor candidate or some political ideology or their fears, right? Like you just said, hey, felon, oh my gosh, this is what I think of, right? And as opposed to our much of our goal and our strategy, and I even hate to use that language because it suggests some sort of, you know, oh, an ulterior motive, as opposed to like, hey, we're all in this together. We're just trying to have a conversation. We're like, we need people in the local community sharing their stories with their family members, with their friends, right? So it's a true reflection of the community. And that was, I mean, we were 100% committed to getting hundreds of people who would be willing to share their stories, so that when folks went and voted, they were voting for their neighbor or their friend or that person at their church, rather than because they love some governor candidate or something like that. And just for the record, like, the media drove me crazy the leading up to the 2 months, because they wanted to reorient the frame right of the last couple months, right, make it all about the politics of it. And we were just like, no, like, talk to this person. This person lives in this community, and then go talk to people who live in that community, and it's people figuring it out. Like, we trust people, you know, to organize themselves in such a way, especially at the local level. Like, hey, what do you think? This is your neighbor. This is what happened to him or her. It might be a violent crime. It might not be. You know, we try not to orchestrate it too much, right? Because that actually, there's a disingenuousness to it, you know, where it's kind of like you get into the community where you're like, hey, everybody's in jail because they got busted with 6 Percocets, you know, while they were on their way to go join the Marines, you know, and you're like, yeah, that's actually not accurate, right? We have people who are guilty and people who made mistakes, right? It's not everybody's actually almost innocent, or, you know what I'm saying? So, like, even to embrace that in the local community, that became like the glue was stuck a lot harder together. And I think that that's hopefully setting us up for long-term success, because it's based on reality at the local level.
We have a few minutes left, and I should come back to Iowa, because obviously this is where most of my audience is located. What's what's the pitch? I mean, you guys have done a good job explaining things and answering the questions right now, but if you had to make that elevator pitch, so to speak, to Iowans that maybe are resistant to this idea yet, you know, what do you tell them in 30 to 60 seconds?
You want me to go, Arthur?
Yeah, go ahead. I also think that maybe we should get our Iowa expert to peep up here too. I think he might know, you know, kind of what is the magical glue for this one. But yeah, I think maybe you should go first.
I would just say that there's power in forgiveness and restoration, and that there is a way to allow people to move forward that ends up creating safer communities and stronger communities for everybody in Iowa, and that to just, you know, support Governor Reynolds in these last 10 days and know that we've seen how this can work and it can help improve a state and transform lives at the same time.
And I would say you can't expect to disinherit generations of Americans from the democratic process and expect to be better for it. At the end of the day, you know, we are a nation built on the principle of forgiveness and, you know, redemption and forgiveness, and hard work can bring you back. And we cannot permanently exclude individuals except in, you know, rare circumstances from that process. Or we will be in the same place we're at, where we just have people who just don't want to participate in society. And when individuals don't want to participate in society, they act accordingly. So the smart and the humane and the dignified approach to this is do everything you can to ensure people come back into the family of and are Americans again. Because how can you call yourself an American if you can't vote? I think that is... it's hard to do.
Drew, are you here? Did you want to speak to any of that?
I'll chime in just briefly, and I have to start with saying I thought of the entire interview, that was the biggest gotcha question when you asked Arthur, a scholar, to provide an answer in 30 to 60 seconds. everybody knows that that's not what people who work at think tanks do. but I agree. I mean, I think this is, and I think Arthur touched on it earlier. Our laws should have goals, and when we focus on what the goal of a piece of legislation is, then we can assess whether or not it's a good idea. So if we go back to, you know, just asking that question, what's the goal that you're trying to achieve by disenfranchising somebody or by removing their right to vote? And then let's look at some data. Does, you know, the goal of our criminal justice system should be public safety? Does taking somebody's right to vote away permanently promote public safety? If the answer is no, then we shouldn't be doing it. And instead, we should be looking to policies that do make our communities safer. This has kind of been woven throughout that conversation. Somebody who feels a part of their community, that has a voice in their community, that is a contributing member of society with the same challenges and opportunities that you and I face, having those people knit together as part of the community makes us all safer. And when you take part of that away, even if they have some other opportunities, and we're doing this a lot in criminal justice reform, they're still a second-class citizen. They're still less than the people around them. And maybe that's not universal across every classification of felon, but if you want your communities to be safer, you have to treat people with dignity and make sure that they have the same opportunities as well as the same responsibilities that everybody else around their community.
All right. I thank you for your guys' time. If you have anything else that you want anybody to know, you know, feel free to share it now. Otherwise, I appreciate it.
Much appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Yeah, man.
Hey, thanks,
thank
everybody.
You.
Happy Memorial
thank
Day.
Thank you, Jacob.
Thanks, yeah. Guys. Thanks,
take care,
Drew.
Guys.